of evidence to suggest that it's actually America which is destabilizing the region, along with its partner, Israel, in that region. And Iran actually just is defending either the oppressed itself or trying to hold back these imperialists.
Thank you. Sorry to jump in. Say Mohsen Abbas from London there, journalist and political commentator. Elijah Magnier, thank you so much. From Marseille, France, journalist and political analyst. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Batahwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of Chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إِنَّ رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين. ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in 6 periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Iran's foreign minister says termination of the Saudi-led coalition siege of Yemen is necessary for the continuation of the existing truce. At least 10 people are killed in a stabbing spree in the Canadian province of Saskatchewan. Police say the two suspects are still at large. Also, the Ukrainian president warns that Europe has to expect a difficult winter as his country's war with Russia has led to cuts in oil and gas exports by Moscow. Hello and welcome from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. Iran's foreign minister says the current truce holding in Yemen wholly depends on the Saudi-led coalition ending its siege of the impoverished country. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a meeting with the UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg. He said Yemen's stability and security has a direct impact on the stability and security of the entire region, including the Persian Gulf. Amir Abdullahian pointed out that the final decision-makers on the future of Yemen are the people of that country. The UN-sponsored truce in Yemen came into effect in April and was renewed in June. It has been the longest respite Yemen has seen during the war and has endured despite multiple violations from the Saudi side. Yemen's oil ministry has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a to shed light on the looting of Yemeni crude oil by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. It says Riyadh and its allies continue to block Yemeni fuel ships and steal the country's oil despite a UN-brokered truce. 4 Israeli troops have been wounded after they were attacked in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military says Palestinians hurled an improvised explosive device near a settlement in the northwest city of Ramallah. The military has launched manhunt and reportedly closed off entrance to a nearby Palestinian village. The incident occurred hours after several Israeli soldiers were injured in a shooting attack on a bus elsewhere in the West Bank. Tensions are mounting across the occupied territories amid Israel's escalating raids and crackdown. Palestinians conduct retaliatory operations to avenge the regime's atrocities. Israel is set to approve the construction of two new settlements comprising more than 3,400 shelter units in the occupied West Bank over the next week. The Palestine Liberation Organization's Colonization and Wall Resistance Commission has disclosed the Israeli plan. It says the regime is considering new settlements on the eastern outskirts of the occupied city of Al-Quds. The head of the commission says some 2,000 Palestinians, including Bedouin communities, are at risk of forced displacement, which amounts to a war crime. All Israeli settlements in the occupied territories are illegal under international law. The UN Security Council has time and again condemned Israel's settlement expansion and called on the regime to put an end to such activities. Remote Canadian communities are shaken by a stabbing rampage. At least 10 people are killed and many more injured in multiple attacks in Saskatchewan province near the border with the United States.
At this point in our investigation, we have located 10 deceased individuals in 13 locations in the community of James Smith Cree Nation and Weldon, Saskatchewan.
Police say they have located the deceased individuals in 13 locations. They say 15 of those injured have so far been transferred to hospitals. Some of the victims are said to have been targeted, while others were randomly attacked. The suspects are still at large. The intention behind the stabbing attacks is not known yet. The police have issued emergency alert all across Saskatchewan and adjoining Alberta and Manitoba provinces. A manhunt has been launched for two suspects. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has described the mass stabbing as horrific and heartbreaking. The Ukrainian president has told Europeans to expect a difficult winter as his country's war with Russia has led to cuts in oil and gas exports by Moscow. Volodymyr Zelensky claims Russia is preparing a decisive energy blow to all Europeans for this winter. He made the comments after Moscow shut down a main pipeline that supplies Russian gas to the continent. Moscow has cited Western sanctions imposed over its war with Ukraine and technical issues for energy disruptions. European countries backing Kiev with diplomatic and military support have accused Russia of weaponizing energy supplies. This comes as European leaders are struggling to ease the impact of high energy prices. G7 countries have already announced a planned price cap on Russian oil exports. The Kremlin says it will stop selling oil to any country that implements the cap. Italy's football league Serie A says it will put a four-hour limit on the use of floodlights in stadiums on match days. It says the measure aims to cut energy use as prices have gone up. That comes as the government in Rome is in talks to adopt energy-saving measures ahead of the winter. Max Civelli has more.
On Thursday, Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a Council of Ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine. Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, three times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that the price cap on gas for power is adopted.
A al prezzo del gas.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
The UK's Conservative Party is set to announce the successor to Prime Minister Boris Johnson in the coming hours. Foreign Secretary Liz Truss and former Finance Minister Rishi Sunak have been vying for the seat. Opinion polls have consistently put Truss in the lead. The contest was triggered by Johnson's resignation in July following a series of scandals that led to several resignations from his cabinet. The winner has to get to grips with the UK's worst cost of living crisis in generations, a double-digit inflation, and soaring energy prices amid the war in Ukraine. Clashes erupt in the Chilean capital after voters overwhelmingly reject reforms to the constitution adopted during the rule of the 1980s dictator Augusto Pinochet. The violence erupted after supporters of the reforms took to the streets of Santiago to show their anger. Riot police used water cannons to disperse the protesters. The reforms proposed by the incumbent president were rejected by 62% of the voters. The opposition has hailed the outcome, calling the results a defeat for the government. The new constitution was proposed after the 2019 student protests that morphed into wider discontent with the country's economic system. Confusion over what the new constitution would be like reportedly led to its defeat. President Gabriel Boric has vowed to continue working to change Chile's political landscape. The United States' history of occupation and intervention in Latin America spans almost 200 years. The U.S. has been present in countries from the north of the continent in one way or another to achieve its own goals. But now the latest U.S. attempts to intervene in Cuba's affairs have drawn a backlash from officials there.
American intervention in Latin America began in 1823 when President James Monroe declared the continent to be a U.S. sphere of influence. Under the Monroe Doctrine, Washington claimed the right to intervene militarily across Latin America. That led to the Banana Wars, in which the U.S. military fought to reassert American power and monopoly of plantations in Central America, Mexico, and the Caribbean. Washington has so far orchestrated and supported many coups across Latin America that have been characterized as U.S. foreign policy in the region since the early 20th century. Throughout history, there's been a lot of U.S. meddling in Latin America, especially in Central America. U.S. foreign policy towards Central America heightened during the Cold War and the spread of the leftist movements and revolutions. Many believe that the success of the Cuban Revolution in the 1950s made the U.S. nervous to think that there could be political superpowers like the USSR at the time, leading them in getting involved in what they perceived as their backyard. All this set the stage for a sustained and violent U.S. intervention across Central America, backing vicious local allies in wars that claimed thousands of lives and displaced millions. The latest U.S. attempts of intervening in Latin America in its long list of interventions is considered as what it calls funding for democracy promotion in Cuba. Havana has, however, slammed the move, saying it's illegal and aimed at toppling the government. Let's not forget the USAID program in Cuba. As it was reported at the time, the U.S. secretly created Cuban Twitter to stir unrest and undermine the government of President at the time, Fidel Castro. It started a social network built on texts in hope that it could be used to organize smart mobs to trigger a Cuban spring. The island nation, which is currently facing its worst economic crisis in decades amid U.S. sanctions, announced electricity blackouts this month. Along with soaring food, fuel, and medicine prices as shortage grips, people are observing long queues for necessities. The U.S. trade embargo, which has been in place against Cuba since 1962, was reinforced under former President Donald Trump. Meanwhile, Trump's successor has also chosen to follow the same path, U.S. intervention has gone far enough that some Congress lawmakers have even advocated for bombing strikes.
We can go back to 1960, in fact, and the Mallory Rubottom memo, it's a State Department memo, that lays out the scenario that Cuba is experiencing today. It says that as secretly as the wording is actually as inconspicuously as possible to disrupt the livelihoods, the employment, the income of the Cuban people. So this has been a policy ever, you know, since 1960, April 6, 1960. The other part of that is that they intend to press the people into rebellion against the government. So clearly, regime change is part of the program.
U.S. President Joe Biden's funding of millions of dollars to opposition groups is just one of Washington's strategies to topple governments in Latin America. According to one source, there have been 41 U.S. interventions in one form or another in Latin American countries. One country where the U.S. has heavily but abortively pushed for regime change is Venezuela.
Venezuela plunged into political turmoil after the U.S.-sponsored opposition figure Juan Guaido launched a botched coup to oust democratically elected President Nicolas Maduro. The attempted coup, which came with the green light off and support of Washington, is yet another example of Washington's intentions with Latin America. The U.S. has even imposed several rounds of sanctions against Venezuela aimed at ousting Maduro and replacing him with Guaido. The sanctions, which include the illegal confiscation of Venezuelan assets abroad and an economic blockade, have caused poverty, a lack of access to basic goods, gasoline shortages, and power cuts. But despite all this, the U.S. seems to have failed in its foreign policy regarding not only Venezuela, but Latin America as a whole, where most of the recently elected presidents have already expressed their ambitions of distancing themselves from the U.S. and establishing stronger ties among themselves.
And, you know, you're not asking this, but there is a new international realignment, and partly I think it's because of these blockades, because of the unilateral action by the United States against countries that are developing to impose its own financial rule on other countries. The United States needs to learn that other countries have a right to determine their own form of government, that their own way of living, that the people in those countries have that right without the United States putting them into debt, without sanctioning them, without creating hardships, and without military attack.
The latest turn of events is also an indication of the U.S.'s failed sanctions policy. Venezuela has, despite the sanctions, managed to double its oil production recently thanks to Iran's help. Iran itself, which is also heavily sanctioned by Washington, is also a prime example of the U.S.'s failed policies, as it has managed to withstand the economic pressure while gradually finding ways around them.
And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
In the limelight.
The Mar-a-Lago resort and its owner, former U.S. President Donald Trump, have become one of the biggest concerns of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, with FBI agents raiding the Trump resort in Florida, known as Mar-a-Lago, to discover and seize confidential documents that Trump took with him after leaving the White House. This home and its owner became one of the biggest challenges and security concerns for the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. The 114-room house is currently the focus of a U.S. Justice Department's investigation into Trump's illegal seizure of presidential documents. Experts believe that the stealing and archiving confidential and national information of the U.S. government by Trump can be seen as an obstacle for him being approved as a candidate in the next U.S. presidential election and even create complex legal problems and challenges for him. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some world press and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Reuters news agency explains more about this big scandal in U.S. intelligence community. It says, some security experts warn the seizure of classified U.S. government documents from Donald Trump's sprawling Mar-a-Lago retreat spotlights the ongoing national security concerns presented by the former president and the home he dubbed the Winter White House. A search warrant shows Trump is under federal investigation for possible violations of the Espionage Act, which makes it unlawful to spy for another country to mishandle U.S. defense information, including sharing it with people not authorized to receive it. Former DOJ official Mary McCord said the Justice Department's search warrant raises concerns about national security. McCord said clearly they thought it was very serious to get these materials back into secured space, adding even just retention of highly classified documents in improper storage, particularly given Mar-a-Lago the foreign visitors there and others who might have connections with foreign governments and foreign agents, creates a significant national security threat. Trump, in a statement on his social media platform, claimed the records were all declassified and placed in secure storage. However, McCord said she saw no plausible argument that he had made a conscious decision about each one of these to declassify them before he left. She said after leaving office, he did not have the power to declassify information. Bloomberg News reported U.S. federal prosecutors are likely to wait until after the November election to announce any charges against Donald Trump if they determine he broke laws. The unprecedented prospect of bringing charges against a former U.S. president is creating intense scrutiny of the Justice Department in the aftermath of its search of his home at Mar-a-Lago. A separate DOJ probe is focused on his effort to overturn the 2020 election, which he lost to President Joe Biden. Under longstanding department policy, prosecutors are barred from taking investigative steps or filing charges for the purpose of affecting an election or helping a candidate or party, traditionally 60 days before an election. This year, that would be by September 15th, which makes it unlikely anything would be announced until after November 8th. The FBI executed a search warrant on Trump's home on August 8th when agents removed 20 boxes of material containing 11 sets of classified material. Announcing charges against Trump prior to the election likely would be seen as a political ploy by his supporters to damage him and his endorsed candidates and could fuel unrest in the country. For example, South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham recently warned during an interview on Fox News, "There literally will be riots in the street if Trump is indicted for mishandling classified information." Trump immediately posted the clip to his social media site. The British daily The Guardian in an article sheds more light on the issue, saying on August 8, when dozens of FBI agents fanned through Mar-a-Lago bearing a search warrant issued by a federal judge, Trump lashed out. He said, "These are dark times for our nation," describing the legally authorized search as a raid and portraying it as a blatantly political attack akin to one of those broken third world countries. Over the past 4 weeks, a cascade of information has been released that tells the other side of the story. It transpires that the unprecedented nature of the FBI search was posited on even more unprecedented behavior of the 45th president of the United States. Trump has been archivally challenged, to coin a phrase, for many years. The roots of his refusal to abide by normal rules relating to documents stretch back at least to his refusal to disclose his own tax returns during the 2016 presidential campaign, a resistance to accepting public access to his personal papers that is the mirror image of his current claim that presidential records from his time in the White House belong to him. Ruth Ben Gitt, a New York University history professor who is author of Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present, and publisher of the Lucid newsletter about threats to democracy, says this blurring of public and private is central to his autocratic style of leadership. Ben Gitt said, "For Trump, records are not just documents. They are a measure of control, leverage over enemies and over his inner circle. This kind of leader doesn't recognize the division between public and private. They have a propriety mode of exercising power in which everything is theirs." By June 2018, such propriety behavior was expressing itself in the White House. Politico reported that Trump was routinely tearing up official records rather than filing them for safekeeping in the National Archives, as he was legally obliged to do. The U.S. government says it is in possession of evidence showing that former President Donald Trump's team tried to obstruct a probe into the discovery of classified documents at the former president's residence. The Justice Department says it had evidence that classified documents were deliberately concealed from the FBI when it tried to retrieve them in June from Trump's Florida estate, prompting an unprecedented search of his home. Prosecutors laid out their evidence of obstruction of justice, saying that Trump aides both falsely certified in June that the former president had retained all the government records he had stored in his home after leaving the White House in January 2021. It also revealed that Trump lawyers explicitly prohibited government personnel from opening or looking inside any of the boxes inside the storage room when FBI agents first traveled to his Palm Beach Mar-a-Lago resort in June to retrieve their records. After the FBI's raid on the Trump's resort, many supporters in some American cities gathered in front of FBI's headquarters to express their protest and demand the dissolution of this institution. Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York and one of Trump's friends and lawyers, also said in an interview with the New York Post that if Trump wins the 2024 election, he will attack Joe Biden's house. While calling the FBI's attack on Trump's home in Florida political, he said if Trump wins the election, he will use the FBI to retaliate and attack Biden's house. Therefore, it can be said that considering the recent scandals in Trump's Mar-a-Lago house and the intelligence disorders inside the former U.S. administration, there is no clear future for Trump to become a candidate and win the 2024 elections. It can also be said that these events will have important effects on the incoming U.S. midterm elections.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this programme, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organisations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will look at the 5 years of the mass exodus of Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar following a brutal military crackdown and their never-ending struggles. And we shall also discuss a new move by the Indian government in Kashmir to give non-locals voting rights in yet another attempt to change the region's demography.
It's been 5 years since hundreds of thousands of persecuted Rohingya refugees were forced to flee their homes in Myanmar following a military crackdown that was described by the United Nations as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. One of the largest stateless populations in the world, Rohingya Muslims, have been denied justice. And even worse, their hosts Bangladesh and India are seeking their repatriation, even though the UN believes that conditions in Myanmar still aren't safe enough for them to return.
On August 25th, thousands of Rohingya Muslim refugees in Bangladesh's coastal district of Cox's Bazar, which currently houses the largest refugee camp in the world, marked the fifth anniversary of what they call the Genocide Remembrance Day. This day, 5 years ago, the Burmese military launched a sweeping campaign of massacre, rape, and arson against a vulnerable ethnic minority, forcing them to flee. According to conservative estimates, about 740,000 crossed the border into Bangladesh to escape the unutterable horror. About half of the Rohingya refugees at Cox's Bazar are children, and the ramshackle camps are prone to fires that have killed many of them over the past 5 years. The camps are also prone to flooding, especially during the annual monsoon season. Efforts to repatriate them have failed so far, despite Bangladeshi authorities maintaining that their repatriation is the only solution to the crisis. On the eve of the fifth anniversary last week, Bangladesh's Home Minister Asaduzzaman Khan said his country wants to ensure the Rohingya refugees can return to safe conditions in Myanmar. But the UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet, who visited the Cox's Bazar in August, said the conditions in Myanmar still were not safe enough for the Rohingyas to return home.
In the horrifying violence that unfolded in Myanmar's Rakhine State 5 years ago, thousands of Rohingya Muslims were killed, women were raped, and houses were razed down. Those who managed to escape the violence are now stranded in Bangladesh's Cox's Bazar and some parts of India. The members of the persecuted community are unable to return home while struggling for survival in refugee camps under extremely miserable conditions. Those in Rakhine continue to face systematic abuses and crimes against humanity.
Rohingya Muslims are believed to have migrated from present-day Bangladesh to Myanmar's Rakhine state during the 17th century. When Myanmar won freedom from British colonialism in 1948, the members of the ethnic community were left stranded in the Rakhine state, denied citizenship under the country's 1982 citizenship law, and seen as outsiders.
It fueled discrimination against the Rohingya Muslims and exposed them to state-sanctioned persecution and genocide. Their migration continued for several years, but in August 2017, the Burmese junta unleashed a ruthless crackdown on them. The savagery, including gang rapes, cold-blooded murders, torture, and destruction of properties, was widely documented by human rights bodies, drawing global outrage. Soldiers were accused of what many world leaders and rights groups dubbed ethnic cleansing. However, Myanmar's then civilian leader and Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi refused to blame the army. No one was held accountable for the brazen acts of genocide and crimes against humanity. Activists maintain that to facilitate the return of Rohingya Muslims to their homeland, the Burmese military rulers must dismantle the structures of apartheid and discriminatory laws against Rohingya Muslims and stop obstructing international initiatives to investigate what happened in Rakhine.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mrs. Sharifa Shakira, Program Associate at Justice for All, Burma Task Force, and founder of Rohingya Women Development Network from Houston, Texas. First of all, welcome to the program, Mrs. Shakira. Now, it's been 5 years since the genocide and the subsequent displacement of the Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar. Now, can you tell us very briefly how the exodus began?
We, the Rohingya people, have been facing genocide since Myanmar's independence, and it has effectively been going on since 1978. Since then, our citizenship was confiscated from us, our rights on education was confiscated from us, our movement was restricted, our people were tortured, killed, murdered, and all of this, it's been taking place is because of our ethnicity, which is Rohingya, as well as our religion, which is Muslim, and of course because of the land as well. And today, because of the genocide that had been taking place for many, many decades, we ended up living in world's largest refugee camp in Bangladesh, with more than 1.1 million people in Bangladesh camp living with living in a limbo with no education, no security, no livelihood, and so on. And we only left with about 600,000 inside the Myanmar, and the rest are everywhere in the world fighting and hoping to be recognized as Rohingya from Burma and to be considered as a citizen and to be given back our rights was confiscated from us, which is our citizen. And we are hoping that one day, inshallah, we can go home as a Rohingya from Burma.
Mr. Shakira, the UN described the state-sponsored carnage in Rakhine as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. So how did the military and the civilian rulers get away with it?
United Nations neither have the power nor wills to do anything against the genocide by the Myanmar military, informal civilians government led by Aung San Suu Kyi. United Nations could call for international sanctions, but it would not be effective.
Mr. Shakira, Bangladesh wants the repatriation of the Rohingya refugees, while the top UN human rights official says the situation in Myanmar still isn't safe enough for their return. So what can be done in such a situation?
Not only Bangladesh would like to repatriate Rohingya, but Rohingya refugees themselves would like to return home at the same time. And it is equally true that the Arakan state in Myanmar are not completely safe enough for the refugees to return home. It is because there are two powerful armies, armed groups that fighting each other over the control, which is the Myanmar military and Arakan army. And between both of them, Rohingya inside are becoming the human shells. And it also true that there is no exact information where Rohingya will be settled after they returning home, because their homes, villages was completely erased by the Myanmar government. In these situations, the international community and the world citizens need to engage all the parties involved, including Myanmar military, China, Bangladesh, as well as Rohingya, to find a long-lasting solutions.
On that note, I would like to thank Mrs. Shakira, Program Associate at Justice for All, Burma Task Force, and founder of Rohingya Women Development Network from Houston, Texas. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
George Laria, J Regional Director of UNICEF South Asia, says about 500,000 Rohingya refugee children have been for the past 5 years living in exile in the refugee camps of Bangladesh. Rohingya activist Aung Kyaw Moo reports about demonstrations by Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh to mark 5 years of their mass exodus and to demand safe, dignified, and voluntary repatriation to Myanmar. Jan Egeland, Secretary General of Norwegian Refugee Council, notes that Rohingya refugees were forced out of their ancestral land, adding that history will punish us if we do not make their safe, dignified, and voluntary return possible.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The controversial move by the Indian government to allow voting rights to non-locals in the contested Himalayan region of Kashmir has drawn anger and outrage from locals who see it as yet another attempt to alter the region's Muslim-majority character. According to the plan, any Indian citizen living temporarily in Indian-controlled Kashmir can vote now, which local population and the political parties see it as a move to permanently disenfranchise, disempower and dispossess Kashmiris and change the region's demography.
The controversial move was announced in August by the federally governed territory's top electoral officer, riling up local political parties as well as mainland India's political opposition. The decision will see about 2.5 million voters added to 7.6 million voters already existing, marking a massive 30% rise. The new voters would include those temporarily living in the region, including military personnel, government and private sector employees, as well as migrant workers. The decision has been blasted by Kashmir-based political parties and main opposition parties in New Delhi. Mehbooba Mufti, a former chief minister of the Himalayan region and a former ally of the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, slammed the move as the last nail in the coffin of electoral democracy in the region. She accused the Narendra Modi government in New Delhi of fraudulently bringing 2.5 million voters and applying Israeli policy in the Muslim-majority region.
We are Kashmiri people. To us, Hindu and Muslim make no difference. We always want them to return and stay alongside Muslims. We are secure with each other.
Omar Abdullah, another former chief minister of the region, accused the Modi government in New Delhi of importing voters to win elections. The People's Alliance for Gupkar Declaration, a political alliance of several regional political parties, has termed the decision unacceptable and warned to go to court. Some Hindu parties have also joined the campaign against the BJP government's latest move.
The latest move by the BJP government in Kashmir follows a series of similar measures in the past 3 years since the abrogation of the region's semi-autonomous status in deeply controversial circumstances. Article 35A of the Indian Constitution was central to Article 370, which established the quasi-autonomous relationship between New Delhi and Kashmir and barred non-locals from owning immovable property or exercising political rights in the region. The revocation of Article 370 paved the road for other similar and controversial measures.
Until August 2019, when the BJP government in New Delhi revoked Jammu and Kashmir's special status by abrogating Article 370 and 35A, voting rights in the region were given only to permanent residents. Article 370 of the Indian Constitution barred people from mainland India from permanently settling in Kashmir, buying land, or holding local government jobs there. On August 5, 2019, Narendra Modi's government unilaterally stripped the region of its special status, setting up a series of similar laws that observers say aimed to change the region's demography. Among the controversial moves was the domicile law that grants citizenship rights to every Indian living in the region for more than 15 years, as well as a law that makes every Indian citizen eligible to buy land in the region.
Autonomy is the best option, if somebody would ask me. More autonomy to the people of Kashmir. Fair elections. Send back forces to barracks, number one. Number two, reach out to the separatists, reach out to the youths, reach out to the common man.
Importantly, the decision to grant voting rights to non-Kashmiris comes after the controversial delimitation exercise, which sparked anger and outrage in the region, as Jammu with less population got 6 additional seats, while Kashmir with more population got only 1 additional seat. People in Kashmir saw the move skewed in favor of the Hindu-majority Jammu. According to the 2000 census of the 12.5 million population in Kashmir, Muslims comprised 68.31% and Hindus 28.43%. More than 7 million of these residents live in Kashmir.
Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Dr. Mohammad Junaid. He teaches anthropology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. He is also a Kashmiri writer whose work on military occupation, politics and memory in Kashmir has appeared in a number of journals, magazines and books. Now, first of all, welcome to the program, Dr. Junaid. Now, the Indian government's decision to give voting rights to non-local Kashmiris has again stirred up controversy and drawn outrage. Now, do you see it as yet another attempt to change the Muslim-majority region's demography?
So, according to Indian election officials in Kashmir, close to 2.5 million Indians who come to Kashmir or who have stayed in Kashmir for a while and decide to vote in the local elections, not the national elections or Indian elections, but the local elections, they will have the right to vote. 2.5 million people is close to 20% of the entire voting population of the state of Jammu and Kashmir. This is a massive shift in terms of how elections have been held in Kashmir over the last 7 decades. We know the history of elections or democracy in Kashmir has always been suspect. There have been rigged elections, people have been chosen or forced to not contest. Now, parties that were close to winning, they were basically forced to accept defeats, voting agents were tortured and whatnot. And Kashmiris have often lost confidence in the Indian electoral system, because the primary goal for Indian security agencies with regard to elections is not democracy, is not to give voice to the people of Kashmir, but to make sure that they have a pliant regime in power there. So this 2.5 million people that are going to be added overnight to the electoral rolls means that the ruling regime in India, led by BJP, they will be the beneficiaries, because they are going to make sure that they give voting rights to those people who vote for their party. Now, the ultimate goal is that since 2019, when India revoked the so-called autonomy in Kashmir and did away with Articles 370 and 35A, it needs some kind of endorsement from the Kashmiri public, because the case is in India's Supreme Court, and it wants to make sure that Kashmiri people are supportive of this. Of course, Kashmiris are not supportive of the changes that took place, but the BJP wants to manufacture that consent now. So that's why they want a pliant regime in Kashmir, particularly led by its own party, that will kind of endorse the 2019 decisions.
Dr. Junaid, Kashmiri political outfits as well as India's opposition parties have condemned New Delhi's latest move in Kashmir. One Kashmiri politician equated it with Israel's policy in Palestine. Now, do you find the parallels striking?
This is happening in the overall sort of context of India trying to take away not only the, rights of Kashmiris to their land, but to sort of change the dynamics of the 7-decade-old conflict by kind of forced demographic alteration. This is not new, of course. Globally, it has taken place. Dominant states, settler states, have sought to, demographically alter situations for indigenous peoples. By changing the facts on the ground, the Indian government wants to sort of alter the conversation altogether, because so far Kashmiris have been talking about their own sovereignty and the unhealed scars of the 1947 partition that left Kashmiris in a limbo. But now India wants to turn it into a sort of a Hindu-Muslim conflict, where the settlers, mostly Hindu from India, would have a privileged existence in Kashmir as compared to the historic population of Kashmiri Muslims and Kashmiri Hindus, which is a small minority of the population, who would sort of be at the mercy of this large new settler population backed by a huge Indian army, which is already kind of present in Kashmir. These tactics are, of course, Indian government officials often talk about this in terms of, sort of making sure that they have a nationalist population in Kashmir. So they're trying to introduce a new population, which is not different from what the United States did, for instance, in its colonies, or what Israel is doing in Palestine, what British did in Australia and New Zealand and so many other places.
Last but not least, sir, is it fair to say that the space for pro-freedom groups and civil society shrunk in the Himalayan region due to India's massive crackdown after the events of August 2019?
So this is a very dangerous new situation that Kashmiris are in. In terms of, the elections, also we have to remember that there has not been an elected assembly. Kashmiri, as I said, they don't vote too much in the elections, but there was sort of an assembly in place in until 2018. And that was dissolved then. It's also interesting because while people are talking about elections, the assembly that might be elected would have very little powers. I know Kashmir is no longer a state now. It's a union territory, and some of the major institutions in the state, like the police, the home ministry, and education, and so many other areas, are directly now controlled by India's federal home ministry. So the whatever body is going to be elected will have very limited say. My sense is that the goal is to have a rubber stamp authority in Kashmir, whose only purpose would be to endorse the August 5, 2019 decision of the Indian government. So whatever elections happen would not alter the situation of Kashmiris. It would simply endorse what is the fact on the ground right now.
On that note, I would like to thank Dr. Mohammed Junaid. He teaches anthropology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts in North Adams, Massachusetts. He is also a Kashmiri writer whose work on military occupation, politics and memory in Kashmir has appeared in a number of journals, magazines and books. Thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Novelist, poet and activist Meena Kandasamy quotes former Kashmir Chief Minister Mehbooba Mufti slamming the move to give non-local Kashmiris voting rights as the last nail in the coffin of electoral democracy in the region. Anis Sargar, a Kashmir-based journalist, reports on the all-party meet called in protests against Indian government's move to allow non-locals voting rights, which has triggered fears of demographic change among locals. Kashmiri political activist Farooq Rehmani terms the move to give voting rights to non-locals in Kashmir as a predetermined settler policy, equating it with Israeli plans in occupied Palestinian territories.
And that was our episode about the plight of Rohingya Muslim refugees persecuted at home and disowned abroad, and also the Indian government's continued attempts to change Kashmir's demography. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
In the limelight.
The United States and its allies invaded Afghanistan 20 years ago, destroyed the country's infrastructure, killed Afghan civilians, and stole their money. And now they seem to be so indifferent to the crisis that is gripping the war-torn country. Although Afghanistan is dealing with a humanitarian crisis, this country seems to be completely forgotten by the U.S. and the West. The UN Humanitarian